Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2, for the record, program number 652, Palin by Comparison. This is being recorded on November 8th of the year 2008. What we're doing in this broadcast, before we begin examining some aspects of Barack Obama's background and ruminating about his election and his presidency to be, by the way, a situation about which I have many more questions than answers, I thought it would be worth taking a good in-depth look at what was running on the Republican ticket, not John McCain, but what was running as his vice president. And when one gets past the superficiality of the Sarah Palin candidacy and the Tina Fey Saturday Night Live chic, one comes across some really, really disturbing things, not just the woman, meaning Sarah Palin's fundamental ignorance about key world issues, but the fact that behind the lipstick on this hockey mom, one finds some overtly fascist and secessionist elements, elements that are, in their essence, profoundly anti-American, and beyond that, elements that are Nazi and fascist. This should not come as too great a surprise, perhaps, to longtime listeners to this program and to serious students of the American political landscape, because, in fact, the Republican Party has long-standing connections to fascism, going back to, well, really before World War II, to the 1934 coup attempt in which many of the industrialists and financiers who paid the Republican bosses attempted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. At the end of the war, many of the most heinous Nazi war criminals and Central and Eastern European fascists were brought into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. Key names there, Alan Dulles, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, William Casey, and ultimately the elder George Bush were the people who helped to cement this Nazi axis inside of the Republican Party. That's Nazi axis in the GOP matured, I guess one could say, with the election of Ronald Reagan and the ascension of a woman named Helena von Damm to the position of selecting the lists from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments. Helena von Damm was the protege of Otto von Bolschwing. Otto von Bolschwing, one of the key Nazi spies in the Middle East, jumped to the CIA. A man who was very close to the Grand Mufti, a man who also became very close to Ronald Reagan. Otto von Bolschwing was Adolf Eichmann's superior in the SS and administering so-called Jewish matters for the Third Reich at one point in time. And Helena von Damm was his protege, and she selected the lists from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments, which is how we find people like the head of Resistance Records and other people openly associated with various Nazi and fascist elements in the administration of Ronald Reagan. I reviewed a few of those in For the Record program number 647, and we'll go over a few more of those later. But so it really should not come as all that much of a surprise to see these kinds of elements connected to the candidacy of John McCain and his selection of Sarah Palin. But I thought I would begin this the post-election series of new broadcasts by discussing Sarah Palin's political background, because we've been talking about organizations like the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, which recognizes minority groups such as the Tibetans, the Lakota, the Hawaiians, and the U.S. and others, the Chechens and others. The UNPO, headed up by Karl von Habsburg, basically supports the rights of small minorities in an apparent attempt to break up larger countries, which could rival an underground Reich and could present a potential obstacle to world fascism at a point in the future. I assume that X number of listeners have perhaps found some of my discussion of the possibility of the U.S. breaking up following an economic catastrophe and perhaps a political catastrophe as well, such as the elimination of a city with weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps that doesn't look quite as strange now. Certainly the U.S. is in dire economic position. And with the first African-American president getting ready to take office, looking at the openly racist, openly secessionist, openly fascist, and the openly neo-Confederate elements that loom in the background of Sarah Palin, I think it is important to take this up and to ruminate about just what might take place under an Obama presidency. Indeed, I think the forces that are grouped behind Sarah Palin and the AIP are the very forces that we've been looking at in connection with the UNPO, in the connection with the seemingly enlightened and progressive agenda of promoting the rights of small minority peoples. But in fact, that seeming libertarian agenda is in fact aiming at breaking up larger countries and at curtailing freedom, and doing so in at the behest of the underground Reich and the forces of darkness. What we're going to do in the second side of the program, in the beginning, is we're going to go back to an article from Salon.com. And again, for people that may have found some of my talk of the UNPO and possible secessionist forces in the U.S., and people, maybe some people found that sort of way out and a bit over the top, take a look at what lies in the background, and really not in the background, but the foreground of Sarah Palin's political career. And Sarah Palin, of course, was the vice presidential nominee. This from Salon.com of October 10th, 2008, article by Max Blumenthal and David Nywert, Meet Sarah Palin's Radical Right-Wing Pals. Now, we've been taking a look at two of the key people in the AIP, the Alaska Independence Party, Mark Chrisen and Steve Stoll. Now, the Alaskan Independence Party is one of the driving forces behind Sarah Palin's political persona, and the AIP in turn is the Alaskan affiliate of the Constitution Party, part of a constellation of fascist and secessionist parties in the United States, with direct evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Aryan Nations, Neo-Confederate League of the South, and others. By way of taking a look at just to what extent Sarah Palin was manifesting the political agenda of secessionists Mark Chrisen and Stephen Stoll, we're going to resume with this Salon.com article from October 10th of 2008. Now, Sarah Palin has joined the Wasilla City Council in 1992, and Mark Chrisen does not trust her. It's at that point that we rejoin the article. Chrisen did not trust Palin when she joined the city council in 1992. He claimed that she was handpicked by Democratic city council leaders and by Wasilla's Democratic major, John Stein, to rubber stamp their tax hike proposals. When I first met her, he said, I thought she was extremely left, but I've watched her slowly as she's become more pronounced in her conservative ideology, unquote. Palin was well aware of Chrisen's views. She knew my beliefs, Chrisen said. The entire state knew my beliefs. I wasn't afraid of being on the news, on camera, speaking my views, unquote. But Chrisen believes she trusted his judgment because he accurately predicted what life on the city council would be like. We were telling her, this is probably what's going to happen, he said. The city is going to give this many people raises, they're going to pave everybody's roads, and they're going to pave the city council members' roads. We couldn't have scripted it better, because everything we predicted came true, unquote. After intense evangelizing by Chrisen and his political allies, they claimed Sarah Palin as a convert. Quote, when she started taking her job seriously, Chrisen said, the people who put her in as the rubber stamp found out the hard way that she was not going to go their way, unquote. In 1994, Sarah Palin attended the Alaska Independence Party's statewide convention. In 1995, her husband Todd changed his voter registration to AIP. Except for an interruption of a few months, he would remain registered as an AIP member until 2002, when he changed his registration to undeclared. In 1996, Palin decided to run against John Stein as the Republican candidate for mayor of Wasilla. While Palin pushed back against Stein's policies, particularly those related to funding public works, Chrisen said he and Steve Stoll prepared the groundwork for her mayoral campaign. Chrisen and Stoll viewed Palin's ascendancy as a vehicle for their own political ambitions. Quote, she got support from these guys, Stein remarked. I think smart politicians never utter these kinds of radical things, but they let other people do it for them. I never recall Sarah saying she supported the militia or taking a public stand like that, but these guys were definitely behind Sarah, thinking she was the more conservative choice, unquote. They worked behind the scenes, unquote, said Stein. I think they had a lot of influence in terms of helping the backscatter negative campaigning, unquote. Indeed, Creighton boasted that he and his allies urged Palin to focus her campaign on slashing character-based attacks. For instance, Creighton advised Palin to paint Stein as a sexist who had told her to, quote, just sit back there and look pretty, unquote, when she served on Wasilla's city council. Though Palin never made this accusation, her 1996 campaign for mayor was the most negative Wasilla residents had ever witnessed. While Palin played up her total opposition to the sales tax and gun control, the two hobgoblins of the AIP, mailers spread throughout the town portraying her as the Christian candidate, unquote. A subtle suggestion that Stein, who was Lutheran, might be Jewish, quote, I watched that campaign unfold, bringing a level of slime our community hadn't seen until then, recalled Phil Munger, a local music teacher who counts himself as a close friend of Stein. Again quoting, this same group, Stoll and Creighton, also publicly challenged me on whether my wife and I were married because she had kept her maiden name, Stein bitterly recalled, so we literally had to produce a marriage certificate. And, as I recall, they said, well, you could have forged that, unquote. When Palin won the election, the men who had once shouted anti-government slogans outside City Hall now had a foothold inside the mayor's office. Palin attempted to pay back her newfound pals during her first city council meeting as mayor. In that meeting on October 14, 1996, she appointed Stoll to one of the city council's two newly vacant seats. But Palin was blocked by the single vote of then-Councilman Nick Carney, who had endured countless rancorous confrontations with Stoll and considered him a violent, unquote, influence on local politics. Though Palin considered consulting attorneys about finding another means of placing Stoll on the council, she was ultimately forced to back down and accept a compromise candidate. Emboldened by his nomination by Mayor Palin, Stoll later demanded she fire Wasilla's museum director, John Cooper, a personal enemy he longed to sabotage. Palin obliged, eliminating Cooper's position in short order. Gotcha, Cooper, Stoll told the deposed museum director after his termination, as Cooper told a reporter for the New York Times, and it only cost me a campaign contribution, unquote. Stoll, who donated $1,000 to Palin's mayoral campaign, did not respond to numerous requests for an interview. Palin has blamed budget concerns for Cooper's departure. By the way, for people who may have just joined the broadcast, I'm reading an article from Salon.com from October 10th of 2008, Meet Sarah Palin's Radical Right-Wing Pals. What we're looking at is the way in which Mark Creighton and Steve Stoll of the Alaska Independence Party basically helped to craft Sarah Palin when she was the mayor of Wasilla, and to a large extent they helped to shape Sarah Palin as a political animal, with its anti-American, overtly secessionist and fascist and Nazi evidentiary tributaries and links, the fact that members of the AIP could have shaped a woman who was to become vice president, the vice presidential nominee of a major political party is worth considering at length and in detail. So that's what we're looking at here. And again, we're looking at the influence of the AIP through Mark Creighton and Steve Stoll on Sarah Palin when she was the mayor of Wasilla. Continuing, the following year, when Carney proposed a local gun control measure, Palin organized with Creighton to smother the nascent plan in its cradle. Carney's proposed ordinance would have prohibited residents from carrying guns into schools, bars, hospitals, government offices, and playgrounds. Infuriated by the proposal that Carney viewed as a common-sense public safety measure, Creighton and his seven allies stormed a July 1997 council meeting. With the bill still in its formative stages, Carney was not even ready to present it to the council, let alone conduct public hearings on it. He and other council members objected to the ad hoc hearing as a waste of time, unquote, but Palin, in plain violation of council rules and norms, insisted that Creighton testify, stating, according to the minutes, that, quote, she invites the public to speak on any issue at any time, unquote. When Carney tried later in the meeting to have the ordinance discussed officially at the following regular council meeting, he couldn't even get a second. His proposal died that night thanks to Palin and her extremist allies. Quote, a lot of it was the ultra-conservative far right that is against everything in government, including taxes, unquote, recalled Carney. A lot of it was a personal attack on me as being anti-gun, and a personal attack on anybody who deigned to threaten their authority to carry a loaded firearm wherever they pleased. That was the tenor of it, and it was being choreographed by Steve Stoll and the mayor, unquote. Asked if he thought it was Palin who instigated the turnout, he replied, "I know it was," unquote. By Chrisen's account, he and Palin also worked hand-in-glove to slash property taxes and block a state proposal that would have taken money for public programs from the permanent fund dividend or the oil and gas fund that doles out annual payments to citizens of Alaska. Palin endorsed Chrisen's unsuccessful initiative to move the state legislature from Juneau to Wasilla. She also lent her support to Chrisen's crusade to alter the Alaska Constitution's language on gun rights so cities and counties could not impose their own restrictions. It took over 10 years to get the language written in, Chrisen said, but Sarah Palin was there supporting it, unquote. With Sarah as a mayor, said Chrisen, there were a number of times when I just showed up at City Hall and said, "Hey, Sarah, we need help," unquote. I think there was only one time when I wasn't able to talk to her, and that because she was in a meeting. Unquote. Chrisen says the door remains open now that Palin is governor. Palin's office did not respond to Salon's request for an interview. While Palin has been more circumspect in her dealings with groups like the AIP as she has risen through the political ranks, she has stayed in touch. When Palin ran for governor in 2006, marketing herself as a fresh-faced performer determined to crush the GOP's ossified power structure, she made certain to appear at the AIP's state convention. To burnish her maverick image, she also tapped one-time AIP member and born-again Republican Walter Hickel as her campaign co-chair. Hickel barnstormed the state for Palin, hailing her support for an all-Alaska liquefied gas pipeline, a project first promoted in 2002 by an AIP gubernatorial candidate named Nels Anderson. When Palin delivered her victory speech on election night, Hickel stood beaming by her side. "I made her governor," he boasted afterward. 2 years later, Hickel has endorsed Palin's bid for vice president. One wonders if, had John McCain been elected president and had Sarah Palin been elected vice president, if her door would have still been as open to these people, or had McCain been elected and then bought the farm, so to speak, one wonders if the White House would have been open to her as well. And if, for example, just for the purposes of discussion, the economy collapses still further, and if some of the neo-Confederate affiliates of the Alaska Independence Party were to succeed in assassinating Barack Obama, perhaps getting a hold of a nuke through whatever channels and lighting it off in Washington, if that might perhaps precipitate the political and economic collapse that would lead to the secession desired by the AI, or the secessions desired by people like the AIP and their neo-Confederate allies. And again, for those listeners who may have thought some of my discussion of the UNPO and related topics was a bit far out, and some of my ruminations on a breakup of the United States were just beyond the pale, so to speak, well, take a look at what you had. Take a look at the pit bull with lipstick that you had running for vice president on the Republican ticket, and bear in mind that the forces that she embodies and represents have not gone away. These Nazi elements inside of the Republican Party have not gone away. Aryan Nations Associated was helping to pick the security clearances for the Reagan administration. These people have not gone away. And what are they going to do in the future? How are they going to react with the first African-American president? We'll see, won't we? More about Sarah Palin and the Alaskan Independence Party. Just months before Palin burst onto the national stage as McCain's vice presidential nominee, she delivered a videotaped address to the AIP's annual convention. Her message was scrupulously free of secessionist rhetoric, but complimentary nonetheless. "I share your party's vision of upholding the Constitution of our great state," Palin told the Assembly of AIP delegates. "My administration remains focused on reining in government growth so individual liberty can expand. I know you agree with that. Keep up the good work, and God bless you," unquote. When Palin became the Republican vice presidential nominee, her attendance at the 1994 and 2006 AIP conventions and her husband's membership in the party, as well as Palin's videotaped welcome to the AIP's 2008 convention, generated a minor controversy. Crisen claimed, however, that Sarah Ann Todd Palin never even played a minor role in his party's internal affairs. She's never been a member of the Alaskan Independence Party, Crisen insisted. Todd has, but most of rural Alaska has, too. I never saw him at a meeting. They were at one meeting I was at. Sarah said hello, but I didn't pay attention because I was taking care of business. But whether the Palins participated directly in shaping the AIP's program is less relevant than the extent to which they will implement that program. Crisen and his allies have demonstrated just as much interest in grooming major party candidates as they have in putting forward their own people. At a national convention of secessionist groups in 2007, AIP Vice Chairman Dexter Clark announced that his party would seek to, quote, infiltrate the Democratic and Republican parties with candidates sympathetic to its hard-right secessionist agenda, quote, you should use that tactic. You should infiltrate, unquote, Clark told his audience of neo-Confederates, theocrats, and libertarians, quote, whichever party you think in that area you can get something done, get into that party. Even though that party has its problems right now, that is the only avenue. Clark pointed to Palin's political career as the model of a successful infiltration. There's a lot of talk of her moving up, Clark said of Palin. She was a member of the AIP when she was mayor of a small town. That was a nonpartisan job. But to get along and go along, she switched to the Republican Party. She is pretty well sympathetic because of her membership, unquote. Clark's assertion that Palin was once a card-carrying AIP member was swiftly discredited by the McCain campaign, which produced records showing she'd been a registered Republican since 1988. But then why would Clark make such a statement? Why did he seem confident that Palin was a true blue AIP activist burrowing within the Republican Party? The most salient answer is that Palin was once so thoroughly embedded with AIP figures like Crisen and Stoll and seemed so enthusiastic about their agenda, Clark may have simply assumed she belonged to his party. Now, Palin is a household name and her every move is scrutinized by the Washington Press Corps. She can no longer afford to kibitz with secessionists, however instrumental they may have been to her meteoric ascendancy. This does not trouble her old AIP allies, however. Indeed, Crisen is hopeful that Palin's inauguration will also represent the start of a new infiltration. I've had my issues, but she's still staying true to her core values, Crisen concluded. Sarah's friends don't all agree with her, but do they respect her? Do they respect her ideology and her values? Definitely. Unquote. And again, as Crisen told an audience of fellow neo-secessionists, at a national convention of secessionist groups in 2007, AIP Vice President Dexter Clark announced, that his party would seek to infiltrate the Democratic and Republican parties with candidates sympathetic to its hard-right secessionist agenda. Is that what we're seeing with Crisen and Stoll and Sarah Palin? And again, there are going to be links talking about the AIP and the Constitution Party. The AIP is basically the Alaskan affiliate of the Constitution Party, which in 2004 endorsed Michael Perutka of the League of the South for president. The AIP basically backed Michael Perutka of the League of the South as president. And Ed Butler of the Aryan Nations also endorsed the candidacy of Michael Perutka of the League of the South. And again, the League of the South is a neo-Confederate white supremacist organization with the first African-American president seated on top of a disintegrating economy. It'll be interesting to see how these forces manifest themselves in the future. And what we're going to conclude with is by taking a look at something which, from a philosophical standpoint, sort of embodies Sarah Palin's, you know, lipstick populist fascism. Again, she sort of represented herself as an every person or an every woman, the hockey mom pit bull with lipstick. And in her acceptance speech at the Republican convention, she had one small line which sounds really wonderful and all-American. One of the quotes that she said, "We grow good people in our small towns," Palin said, quoting someone identified only as a writer, "with honesty and sincerity and dignity." And as a writer in the blog sphere noted, that was actually a quote of a syndicated columnist from the 1930s and 40s named Westbrook Pegler. And I'll give the URL, by the way, for this particular blog article. The author notes, "That writer, Wall Street Journalist columnist Frank Thomas notes, is a man named Westbrook Pegler. You have probably never heard of him, but he was a very popular and very right-wing columnist from the first half of the 20th century. How right-wing? He openly wished for the assassination of Franklin Roosevelt, for one. And for two, he was quite the anti-Semite. He hated Jews so much that the far-right anti-Semitic John Birch Society banned him from their journal." And again, it sounds like a wonderful statement. "We grow good people in our small towns with honesty and sincerity and dignity." Wonderful statement. Sounds great. Real all-American, real Norman Rockwell. But in fact, that comes from Westbrook Pegler. And George Seldes, arguably the dean of American investigative reporters, in his 1943 book Facts and Fascism, devoted an entire chapter to Poison Pen Pegler, as he called him. And a little bit about this writer from George Seldes' Facts and Fascism, published in hardcover by InFact Incorporated in 1943. By the way, the book is now online. "It is the opinion of many persons and organizations that one of the most widely known and read newspaper columnists, Westbrook Pegler, is aiding the Axis rather than the United States in this war. It is a fact that the New York Newspaper Guild, the organization of thousands of Pegler's colleagues, so stated when it sent President Roosevelt a documentation of 12 instances out of Pegler's writings. It is a fact that newspapers, columnists, radio orators, and others who form public opinion have served the Axis propaganda. It is also true that too frequently those who know and who make these charges do not name names. They therefore emasculate their own words." Here, for example, is the director of the U.S. Conciliation Service, Dr. John S. Steelman, who wrote, "Careless recital of the dramatic side of strikes in the press and on the screen and over the radio has given too many people the impression that our war efforts are being held up in a serious way because of willful strife in a major part of American industry. This is a dangerous lie that serves the purpose of the Axis, but serves no good end among us," unquote. Dr. Steelman knows the culprits, but he is not in a position to name them. He is aware that Kaltenbrunner on the radio, Pegler in the newspapers, the entire Hearst and Howard Press are those guilty of careless recitals about strikes. And I will put the URL for this particular online edition of George Seldes' Facts and Fascism, again, with an entire chapter called Poison Pen Pegler about Westbrook Pegler, whose wonderful, all-American-sounding, populist-sounding words Sarah Palin quoted in her acceptance speech. But in fact, she was quoting the words of a virulent fascist columnist. And again, the manifestation of an elitist, corporatist political philosophy as something beneficial to and part and parcel to the small town every person is part of a mythology of fascism. It's part of the mythology of the corporate state. And it's to a certain extent what Sarah Palin was manifesting with her nice, wonderful, homespun sounding presentation at the Republican convention. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 652. Palin by comparison. For references and some of the material that I've made references to in this broadcast, spitfirelist.com is the website. New site, same fight. This has been recorded on November 8th of 2008. My name is Dave.